Hello, my friends. I am Patrick Wyman, and welcome to another episode of Past Lives. I've spent an inordinate amount of time thinking about Lewis and Clark and their epic journey into the American West over the course of my life. A great deal of my childhood involved trips to places they'd gone, thinking about the extraordinary variety of people who were part of the core of discovery, and imagining myself going along with them, if we're being honest about it. I read Stephen Ambrose's Undaunted Courage when I was maybe 12, and ever since then, I have been hoping that somebody would write something up to date. Well, folks, today's guest has gone above and beyond the call of duty on that front. Craig Fairman is a journalist, historian, and author, and his new book is entitled This Vast Enterprise, A New History of Lewis and Clark. It is absolutely outstanding. It is one of my favorite books I've read in the last few years, and I am so excited to talk about it with him. Craig, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, man, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What brought you around to the topic of Lewis and Clark?
Honestly, I wanted to write a big adventure story. I wanted to try to, you know, write one of those books like Undaunted Courage that we grew up reading where the pages kind of turn themselves. And so I was thinking, you know, what are the great American adventure stories? And the number one candidate's pretty obvious. It's Lewis and Clark. But I also didn't want to just do a rehash. I didn't just want to reheat other people's work. So I went back to the journals. And from the start, I realized that there were new things to say. Let me give you an example. This is early on. This is while they're still in St. Louis. They're building their first winter quarters. The expedition hasn't even started yet. And there's this one line, only time York is mentioned during this time period. York is the black man who Clark enslaved, who's on the whole expedition. So in this one line, Clark writes that York, quote, commenced sawing with a whipsaw. And I just started thinking. I was like, well, what's a whipsaw? It's a really important tool that turns logs into planks. You need those planks when you're building winter quarters. You got to have a roof. You got to have a bed so you're not sleeping on the ground. So this was a very essential tool and a tool that required real skill to use. Well, why York? There were dozens of white soldiers around this camp. Clark was there himself. Why did they pick York? What does that tell us about York's background? What does that tell us about how York separates himself from Clark? In this one line, I could see the start of a story involving York that would go all the way to the Pacific Ocean, where York navigated these difficulties and found a way to kind of create his own experience and make his own choices as much as possible. So there were other lines like that. I found a lot of new stuff in the archives too. But reading those lines, I was like, I only know half the story. Readers only know half the story. Let's take another swing at this and see if we can get the whole thing down, because the whole thing was, again, the great American epic.
You talk about York there. And for the listeners, the way this book is set up is you rotate between perspectives for every chapter, that every chapter is looking at what's happening from a different person's point of view. You know, you've got 10 different people. Some of them we only meet once, some we come back to a couple of times. But every chapter, we're looking at these fairly, you know, well-documented events from a different person's perspective. I mean, perspective is a word we're going to be using a lot today. How did you decide to do that? What was the impetus behind that?
I knew I wanted to write a page turner, like I said, but I knew that I wanted a different narrative engine. So many of the kind of page turners we grew up with are sort of, they feel preordained. They feel motivated by sort of certainty and heroism. And those make good stories, but they're not the only way to tell a good story. And so for me, this book felt like it was driven by contingency, which I know is kind of a fancy academic word, but it's not hard to understand. It's just like, how do you live your life? Do you know who's going to win the next presidential election? No, you don't. Well, neither did Lewis and Clark. Like, you don't know what tomorrow is going to look like. So this idea of contingency, this idea of like multiple sites of power, that was my narrative engine. I wanted people to feel nervous. I wanted people to feel excited. I wanted people to feel unsure, because that's what Lewis and Clark felt too. And so the rotating points of view felt like a way to sort of bring those ideas from the academic realm to the storytelling realm. I just think it makes it a better story when you're switching points of view like that, when you're getting different people's perspectives on the same events. Let me put it this way. I think biography is kind of a superpower. It's a shortcut, right? Like, if you're reading somebody's biography, you're by definition seeing the world the way they see it. You see what they care about. You see what they want. You see how they think. But we can choose who gets that superpower, who gets biography. But I also wanted York to get the powers of biography. I wanted Sacagawea to get it. And so when I decided on this structure, I really wanted to sort of use those tools that readers respond to, but try to use them in a new way.
I could not possibly agree more with you, because, I mean, that's very much what we do here on Past Lives, right? It's, who are we going to talk about? Who do we choose as a subject who is worthy of exploration? Whose eyes are we going to look at the world through? And in this book, we have Black Buffalo, who's a Lakota leader. We have York, who's enslaved. We have Sacagawea, who you quite rightly and emphatically, I'm really glad that you did this, you say she is a slave. She's not a wife, except in the loosest possible term. She is an enslaved person. And that is a much different and much more powerful and accurate way of understanding who she is and her position in this society. And I'm so thankful that you did that. But they are viewpoint characters. Looking at the world through their eyes illuminates it differently. I'm so glad you did that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And to be perfectly clear, like Clark said, she was enslaved. Like there's an interview he gave after the expedition where he talked about Sacagawea and another Shoshone woman who lived with her. And he said they were slaves. So this is not, you know, a modern academic viewpoint. This is how people saw the world back then. We just have to kind of strip away the layers of folklore and myth and storytelling that have been layered on top of it. But I also think this makes it a more inspirational story because the classic idea of Sacagawea as the plucky tour guide, that's true. She did do that. But if you understand how dark her life was before that, first of all, you understand she's making a very strategic choice there. She is helping the captains because she knows they will help her. They will protect her. They will help ensure that she and her son stay alive and that she and her son make it home. So she's a very rational, strategic, smart person. But also, if you see what she had to go through, that just makes everything else she does more inspiring. Like it's a better story if you understand the truth of her life because she had to overcome so much. She did overcome it, and that's all in the book, too.
This was really powerful for me because my daughter is 7, and she is obsessed with Sacagawea. She has multiple books on Sacagawea. She reads them all the time. I took her to Fort Clatsop last summer. She was obsessed with the room that Sacagawea slept in with the baby, and I have always been clear with her that Sacagawea was a slave. I don't think that there's an age that's too young to learn that. You don't have to inject the feel-good story only to remove it later. If you are old enough for something to happen to you, you are old enough to be told the truth about it. Maurice Sendak said that about children's stories. And I firmly believe that with history. I don't want my daughter, who loves the idea of the plucky tour guide, the woman who survives all of these things, I don't want her to think that that's necessarily a sunshiny, bright story, that there was real struggle. That comes through so clearly in the way that you write this. And same with York, too, who's another one of your viewpoint characters. We spend a lot of time with York. And the relationship between York and Clark is one of our best documented relationships between an enslaved person and their owner in this period of time. Like, that's an incredible resource to have.
Yeah, I always like to say that I didn't write a book about slavery. I wrote a book about York. But in telling York's story with as much detail and as much empathy as I can muster, you kind of do tell the broader story at the same way. And hopefully you tell it in a way that it's a better story, that it's more engaging. Because again, biography is a superpower. If you can put people in the shoes of people who lived in the past with the best resources we have, then it's just more fun to read about. And it hits harder in terms of emotions and ideas and all that stuff. So yeah, the documentation we have on York is incredible. But let's also give some credit to York here too, because there were other expeditions in this time period. Jefferson was a busy guy with a big vision. And so I went and read the journals from other expeditions, and there were other enslaved people on those expeditions. I'm sure they worked really hard. I'm sure they sacrificed a lot, but we don't even know their names. That tells you something about the leaders of those other expeditions, that Lewis and Clark were more curious, were more careful, but it also tells us something about York. And it tells us that he really was an exemplary human being who gave everything he had and was essential to the expedition, you know, achieving everything it did.
It is a powerful statement of the agency of enslaved people in the way that you present York, that he is a person who is making his own choices. You tell us there are times when clearly he and Clark are clashing, or they have different ideas about what York is supposed to be doing and what their relationship is supposed to be. And the way you handled that throughout was, speaking of exemplary, the way that you were able to portray that relationship was, but you really get into the muddled psychology of an owner and an enslaved person on whom he relies and just how messed up that is. This is one of the best portrayals I think I've ever read of the just how screwed up that relationship is.
Thank you for saying that, but we got to give some credit to William Clark here. There are a lot of things to admire about Clark, but one of the things that is pretty odious is his treatment of enslaved people. What's wild, though, and I think this just speaks to how much it was encoded in his worldview, how much he could not detach from it, is that he's the one who preserved all these documents for us. There's a letter to his brother where he says, you know, I hope you don't think I'm a severe master. So we can tell that Clark himself was thinking about this in moral terms. He wasn't thinking slavery is wrong, but he was thinking there's a right way to do this and a wrong way to do this. And yet there's another letter to his brother where he admits that he whipped one of his female slaves who was 8 months pregnant. All of that stuff is existing in the same mind at the same time, and that can't help but warp things. I mean, the person who suffered the most, obviously, is York and frankly, York's whole family. And I try to track in the book the suffering that happened. One of York's half-brothers ran away. And one of the images I preserve in this book is a runaway slave ad that Clark placed for this. And in it, it talks about that this enslaved person's name was Juba. It says that Juba stutters a little. We know from scholarship that lots of enslaved people stuttered and that it was a psychological symptom of the torture they had to go through. So that's what happened to York's brother. Similar things happened to York too. Clark was the one who inflicted that, and he had an economic rationale for it. But at the same time, he didn't want to be a severe master. He knew what he was doing, and he tried to make peace of it, but I don't think he ever quite succeeded. And that's why in his own documents, he sort of preserves that ugly psychological dynamic that just, how else could you make a system like this work?
It requires you to do an incredible amount of mental gymnastics to justify it to yourself. But one of the things that was really fascinating is you point out that there are real contrasts in the way that Lewis and Clark think about slavery, despite the fact that they come from pretty similar backgrounds. They are extraordinarily close friends, rely on each other for years, had known each other for years even before the expedition, but that Lewis did not bring an enslaved person on the expedition and Clark did.
Honestly, this is why this book took me 5 years, because I could remember a moment when I was writing this, when I was like, you know, there's lots of great details. There's lots of great action. If you can't write a fun story about Lewis and Clark, you should probably look for a different profession. But the part that was holding me up was, well, do I really understand how Clark sees slavery? Do I understand how Lewis sees slavery? Do I understand as best as I'm able how York sees slavery? The enlisted soldiers saw slavery in a different way. And so at some point I was trying to kind of avoid all that. And I was like, nope, I just like the only way out is through. And so I remember reading really good scholarship about churches in Kentucky, for instance. And during this time period, they were having splits over the morality of slavery. You know, half the congregation was like, we can't have slavery in the state. The other half was like, slavery's fine. What are you talking about? And a lot of the soldiers came from Kentucky. So this was the firmament that these white soldiers were growing up in. And so I think it's very believable that, you know, some of the men felt that way and some of the men felt differently. Now they're all thrown on an expedition together, but it doesn't make sense to talk about a man of their era. It doesn't make sense to generalize about this because different people believe different things. And the same thing is true about Native issues as well. That took a lot of work too, because you can kind of flip the polarity here in that Clark, while still somebody who was an agent of empire, was an agent of expansion, he could be personally quite kind to Native people and Native people liked him. There's a lot of documentation that Native people enjoyed dealing with Clark. Lewis had a much uglier relationship to Native people. Now, he was better than a lot of the people who were leading those other Jefferson expeditions. But if you contrast Lewis and Clark in terms of Native stuff, you have to understand how they each saw their world. And Clark was a little more progressive towards Native people, Lewis a little more ugly.
What was fascinating to me is when you track those attitudes back through their lives and try to get to kind of where do these ideas come from? What are they shaped by? How do they end up thinking the things that they think? Some of it you can see clearly, like, so you mentioned that Clark went to college for a year. He takes classes. He learns to think about Native people in particular ways. Lewis has a whole different set of experiences. As far as slavery, though, both of their families owned enslaved people. And somehow Clark ends up with one set of views and Lewis ends up with another. And you wonder how much of that is their families, how much of that is just their own personalities. Lewis is a loner. He likes going off by himself. He doesn't want to be bound. And I think there's an independent streak in him, I think, that kind of rebels at the idea of slavery. Whereas in Clark is a man made of slaves, you know, as the saying goes.
Yeah, these things, it's always so complicated to find one cause. And I think this is the way I would put it. It was easier for Lewis to walk away from the institution of slavery than it would have been for Clark. But at the same time, Lewis did still walk away from it. And so, like, both things are true at the same time.
You mentioned that when Lewis goes to work as Jefferson's secretary, Jefferson offers him an enslaved servant, and Lewis refuses.
He turns it down. And even at the end of his life, after they come back from the expedition, when Lewis is now the governor of the Louisiana Territory, a very important role, he declines to have an enslaved person or a body servant. And instead, he has a part-time freed black man who helps him out instead. This is one of those things that's so speculative, you can't even prove it. But the end of Lewis's life, he's under extreme financial pressure. He owns lots of land, but he does not have enough money. And the obvious move there would be to, you know, hire it out to people who own enslaved people or bring in your own slaves or do something like that. Like, obviously, in this time period in America, if you're a white guy and you own a lot of land, there are avenues available to you to profit off that land. Lewis never did that. I don't know why. But when you look at the larger pattern, when you look at how the Lewises treated their slaves versus how the Clarks treated their slaves, I feel comfortable speculating that, again, Lewis just had a different attitude than Clark. And then that makes you wonder, did this ever come up on a canoe? Did this ever come out when they were hanging out in the teepee? I don't know. They're so similar, but they're also so different, which, I mean, that's just a definition of human beings.
This is something that comes through so clearly in the whole book. Your portrayal of these people is so intimate. And that's one of the main things I want to focus on. But what allows us to do that are sources. So what kind of sources do we have that allow us to draw these incredibly intimate portraits of these people?
Well, the first source is the journals. Jefferson tasked them with recording journals and making copies. So Lewis and Clark kept journals, multiple enlisted men kept journals, and some of those journals have been lost, but a lot of them have not. So we have more than a million words to work with. The writing is beautiful in these. It's what you'd expect an Enlightenment document to be, very precise, very observational. Obviously not without its own biases, but still, you know, good writing, crisp writing. So we have that to start with. We have letters between Lewis and Jefferson, Lewis and Clark, but that's really just the start. Because of the perspectives, because of switching points of view, I really tried to almost think about this as writing a mini biography for each one of my 10 point of view people. And so when I was writing about York, I was reading lots of slave narratives of people who lived in Kentucky. Sacagawea, she shows up in the journals a lot. So I was evaluating that, but I was also reading this new body of academic work on Native enslavement. And there's been a great book by a guy named Brett Rushforth written about the French and how they enslaved Native people in the West in this time period. That book totally changed how I saw Sacagawea. It's a great book. And then also Native traditions. Like I interviewed Shoshone people. The Hidatsa have put out a really fascinating book about Sacagawea that has some interesting ideas and some great details in it. So you just sort of synthesize all this stuff and then try to find out the truth or as close as you can get to it. And when you can't quite know the truth, that's when you hedge and you use your perhapses and your mayhaves and you just try to be responsible and then document it too. This book has 40,000 words of endnotes. And I tried to keep a real clear division of church and state. I was like, I want this to be a page turner. This is very much my attempt to write like a David McCullough style book. But at the same time, I do my homework and I want people to know that. And if people want to do their own work or if people are interested in Sacagawea, like your daughter, get her a copy of Brett Rushforth's book. Like she can go to town on an academic press title, I think it sounds like. So I wanted people to be able to find that stuff and to put it in there. So I tried to have it all. I tried to have the adventure story and I tried to have the academic rigor too.
Something that's so fascinating is like the sheer amount of material that you have here. It's almost too much. It's almost too much to be able to absorb, but you did. And you found new stuff as well. Like one of your main point of view characters is John Ordway, who was effectively the first sergeant of the expedition. You went and you looked up archives in the town that he grew up in. You went and you figured out maybe the farm that his family sold that he had grown up on. I mean, that is an extraordinary amount of detailed research, but it comes through. Like this book is I mean this in the most positive way. Your book is an iceberg with what you see on the pages. The amount of substructure underneath it is frankly stunning.
Thank you for saying that. That's why it took 5 years. Sometimes even to write a simple sentence, an engaging sentence, you have to believe it yourself. You have to know it yourself. And when I put a perhaps in my book, that's not wild speculation. That's I'm 98% sure, but there's no way to be 100% sure. So I'm going to be rigorous and careful, but I speculate with that kind of substructure undergirding it. Ordway is a great example. I found myself thinking, because we think of Lewis and Clark, but their experience of the expedition was so different. The army was kind of terrible in this time period. I mean, it was a rough experience. And the American army wasn't quite as bad as, you know, the French and the British army in this time period, but it was still pretty bad. So with Ordway, I would figure out who his officers were, because it's not like John Ordway is going to show up in anything other than a muster roll. But I figure out who his captains were at the company level. And then I would track them through old newspapers. I would track them at the National Archives to sort of figure out where he deployed and sort of figure all the different places he went before Lewis and Clark. And his existence was miserable. Like you can understand what the expedition meant to him. Like, obviously, it wasn't a chance for an adventure, but this is a guy who was 4 years in a 5-year enlistment, and all he had really done was, you know, build a crappy hut to live in, move a few hundred miles, build another crappy hut, and that was it. He was just shuffling around at the whims of President Jefferson, not even sure why he was doing it or what he was doing it, watching his men die from malaria, watching a tornado sweep through his fort. And so when you understand that kind of grueling, brutal, thankless existence, and now all of a sudden these two captains you've been reading about in the newspaper show up and they're like, hey, you want to go with us to the ocean? I can't imagine how excited he must have been.
He is a character that I absolutely love. And one of the things that comes through really strongly in his chapters and throughout the book too, like you don't just toss this in for detail, it's woven into the thread of the book, the intense physicality of the experience, that this was just grueling doesn't begin to describe it. Brutal, I mean, in every possible way. How did you decide to weave that into the thread of the book?
There were a few things, but one of them was honestly kind of personal. I wrote about this in an essay for Defector, which some of your listeners may enjoy. It's a wonderful website. Subscribe if you're not checking it out. They do great stuff on sports and culture. But they let me write about this experience that happened to me about a year and a half into the book. You know, it's 5 years to write it. And I was just out on a walk one night in my neighborhood and kind of saw something in my peripheral vision, and like some little bell in the back of my brain was like, back up. And so I'm scooting back, and then all of a sudden I'm on the ground and I can feel these jaws clamped into my leg and I can feel them grinding and tearing. And so what happened was a dog, somebody had unleashed their dog, and that person was not outside. It was night. It was basically a deleted scene from The Revenant. Like, I don't want to get too graphic. Go read the Defector essay if you want the details, but it was brutal. And so it took a while to come back from that. I'm doing better now. Shout out to my therapist. First, that made me think about the kind of physical stuff you're talking about. It made me think, like, it's not enough for me to just say they had to tow a boat. I've got to talk about how cold the water was. I got to talk about the rocks lacerating their feet. I got to talk about the infection creeping into those cuts and making their feet swell. They got terrible infections under their fingernails. And Lewis writes about this in the journal. That's how granular these journals are. So I knew I wanted to get those details. But the dog attack also kind of reminded me that I will never be able to truly access this stuff, because although this was life-shattering for me, to them, this was literally just a Saturday, literally, because there's a Saturday in the journals when Clark's like, a wolf attacked our camp. It bit a few people. We killed it. And then everybody just moves on. So it's one of those things where both you feel like I got to try to capture that physical suffering, but I also, as a historian, have to keep in mind that I will never fully re-inhabit that mindset, because something isolated and horrible for me, where I also have antibiotics and therapy and all these tools that I can help me, they didn't have any of that stuff. And that same thing might happen to them the next day too. So I appreciate you flagging that, because it was really important for me to put that in the book. And I do think that personal event was part of the reason why.
It makes the whole story more powerful. And it really helped me identify with the people. And, you know, I try to do this in my own work, but like, we live in our bodies. We are corporeal creatures. I think that to the extent that we can, when we have the evidence to be able to do so as historians, we need to talk about the body and the experience of living in the body and what that feels like and what it's like when you get a giant abscess that has to be drained, which is something that happens all the time. You talk about abscesses, boils. People don't like talking about abscesses and boils. They may talk about a broken bone, but like, the resulting infection very rarely gets that kind of attention.
Well, and Clark, in the journals, he talks, like he says, I drained a half pint of fluid. Just matter of fact, again, but still, like, I want readers to see that half pint, because that's what it was like. And like, the expedition was amazing. There is obviously a part of me that wishes I could go on something like that and experience that. Like, what reader wouldn't feel that? That's part of the reason the story is popular. That's part of the reason the story is important. But at the same time, if you want to romanticize it, I think you should imagine the half pint of fluid being drained out of your abscess as well.
So how did they survive this? Because we're talking about years and years and years of this. Diet, medical treatment. I mean, one of the things that was becoming popular in kind of the sociology or the anthropology of medicine is like health making through community. And it seems like this would have been a good example of that. But like, how did they survive? That seems insane.
Sometimes the medicine just made things worse. One detail I remember is when they were doing the portage. So this is one of the most physically grueling parts of the entire expedition, where they've got to move not just all their cargo, but their boats across 20 miles of dry land, because they're out in the plains and there are no trees to make more canoes. So they cannot leave this stuff behind. And so they're doing this, and one of the men stumbles into camp with sunstroke. And Lewis is very caring. Lewis takes care of him. Lewis is cooking for the men. So this is not a knock on Meriwether Lewis, but Lewis follows the scientific protocols of his time, which is to bleed the guy, which is the worst possible thing you should do to somebody suffering from sunstroke. But that's what he did. The guy still recovered. The guy still survived. And that gets at your question, like, how did they survive this? And I think part of it was age. Most of them were in their 20s. I'm 41 now. So I think that helped them some. I think a lot of it was just luck. And the other thing I would say, though, is that, you know, they survived the expedition, but a lot of these people died in a decade or so after. You know, we can't know this for sure, but we do know that STIs were a real issue for the expedition. If you want to talk about bodily experiences. Like Lewis, again, brought the best technologies, which were doses of mercury and also things called penile syringes, which we can maybe leave it at that. Lewis was trying to treat the men, but we know that several of the men who were documented to suffer from syphilis ended up dying a few years after. And the timeline lines up exactly with somebody who would die from tertiary syphilis. So they did survive, mostly through luck. Only one of the soldiers on the expedition died, probably of appendicitis, which even if he had been at the best hospital in America at that time, he still would have died because of the state of technology at that time. But a lot of people did not live many years after the expedition. And Lewis, you know, fits in that category too. Lewis's struggles were mental as much as physical, but this war on all of them, they paid a price to achieve what they achieved.
People ask me this all the time, and they're like, what happened to people in the past? And I'm like, well, they died. Like, I don't know how else to put it to you. Well, they must have done something. Like, no, they just died. That was it. They had medicine. These people weren't idiots. Like, they understood how to set broken bones. They understood how to deal with cuts. They understood, I mean, to the extent it was possible, internal medicine, given the tools at their disposal. They had medicine, often quite effective. They're getting much better at treating malaria, right? And it's not like they don't know anything, but they are limited by what's at their disposal. And the alternative was just you were sick or you died. I mean, especially with kids, I think about infant mortality all the time. It's like, well, how did they deal with it? They didn't mourn their children any bit less. They just had to do it more often. It's just talk about things that are different in the past. Like, it just sucks. Like, there's no way around that.
This is one of those things that, again, just feels inaccessible to me about the past, in that there's a biological imperative behind mourning your children, right? Like, there are certain neurochemical overlaps that human beings share across time periods. But at the same time, the frequency of it would have to make it change in some ways. You can read journals and letters from this period and understand a parent's grief. But if that parent is on the fourth go-around of that grief with eight kids, it must feel a little different in some way too. And that's, people love parallels with the past, but I often find that the disconnects seem to stand out to me more. And it's just, I just feel like as a historian, you have to have both in mind. Like, they were like us and they were different than us. And you have to make peace with the fact that you'll never quite know which similarity or dissimilarity is governing a particular moment.
It's something we're never going to be able to get around. But I think the first step is always being aware of it. It's so easy to homogenize or to try to put ourselves exactly in those shoes without recognizing that, like, the shoes are always a little bit different. They're never quite going to fit, no matter how close you get. Even, you know, we're talking 220 years ago, relatively brief stretch in the spans of time we're used to talking about here. But that's a long time. That is 7-8 generations. A lot of things change in 7-8 generations. I mean, like, talking to my grandma when I was a kid, her mother died when she was very young. Her sister had tuberculosis. They gave up her baby brother to go live with the maiden aunts because her single father couldn't deal with it. Those are not experiences that are anywhere near as common today. And that was two generations ago. There are aspects of my grandmother's mindset that frankly don't make sense to me. How much different does it get going back 5 generations more?
Again, this is where I think the journals help, because what I tried really hard in this book to do is, I wondered these things while I was writing, but I tried not to put my editorializing in there. I just tried to put you in the canoe. I tried to put you with the abscess. I tried to put you, you know, not the penile syringe, I guess that's where I drew the line. You know, I tried to put you in the experience. And like, I hope people who read this book have the same kind of thoughts and reactions that we're talking about, because we do have a lot of details preserved, even though it's so far back. But did those details mean or feel or signify something slightly different? Yeah, I think they did. And the expedition's just such a wonderful tour of the kind of bodily details that separate our time from theirs.
I cannot get over the intimacy of the way in which we can know these people. I had never known that Sacagawea had what was almost certainly a sexually transmitted infection. And that, speaking of people who died young, seems pretty hard to avoid the conclusion that that would have played a role in it. And you mention a note where you say, like, one of the captains, was it Lewis, who was like, yeah, Charbonneau gave that to her.
It was actually from the Shoshone. There are different Native nations who have different traditions about where she died. I honestly don't know which one is true, but Clark thought she died very young. And there's some other documentary sources that hint at that. So whether she died young or not, she definitely had some kind of illness that would show up again and again. She had an immune system that was being ground down from this. And Lewis in the journal, and I think this is a great example of the method that I tried to use. Lewis in the journal records her symptoms in such detail that I could talk to modern doctors and they'd be like, that's probably a flare-up of a pelvic inflammatory disease. Like, that's how precise they could be. And that is often symptomatic of a gonorrheal infection. And then when I talk to my Shoshone sources, what they say is she had a disease. Charbonneau, her owner, gave it to her, and that's what killed her. And so you can bring these two kinds of knowledge together and you can see that they don't clash. They actually illuminate each other and they give us a fuller understanding of what she went through and the price that she paid.
One of the things that I love about this book is precisely that you find the macrocosm in the microcosm, and that each one of these portraits that you're drawing, each one of these people through whose eyes we're seeing this, is effectively showing us a much bigger and broader world in the very best way. You can write this story as an adventure. It goes from point A to point B. But the other way to do this is to find the much larger intersections of things that matter in the early 19th century world. And I think that's what you've done here, because there are portraits of slavery. There are portraits of the relationship between native peoples and the expedition. The psychological portrait of two 19th century gentlemen, and then you have the common soldiers, the differences between them. There's so much here.
This is, again, where I feel like I need to give credit to academics like Brett Rushforth, in that, you know, in his book, he documented that thousands of native women were enslaved, that thousands of native women suffered in ways very similar to Sacagawea. I'm doing something different, though. I'm trying to tell Sacagawea's story. But if I did it right, details about her survive that allow us to use biography to make her life feel real and feel accessible. And you can see what she cared about. You can see how smart she was. You can see how tenacious she was. But you can also see how much she suffered, because it's always both. That's just being a human being. When you understand her story, then you can also understand that this happened to thousands of women that, unfortunately, their names do not survive. Their experiences do not survive, but you can bet that they were similar, possibly even worse than Sacagawea's.
So speaking of Sacagawea, and York is another one that comes to mind when we think about this, this was a defining moment for a lot of them. This journey changed them in real ways. I mean, how did they change? And to your way of thinking, were these beneficial changes? I mean, obviously, it shortened some of their lives, but like, in what ways did this change them?
I think York is a really fascinating example of this, in that I think it's important to pay attention to York's choices. I wish he had had better choices. I wish he had had more choices. He didn't, because of the realities of slavery in his time. But that doesn't mean he had no choices. That doesn't mean he wasn't able to do some things. So even the fact that he was a body servant, this is the term of the time that sort of talked about kind of a favorite slave, another term of the time. He took care of Clark. He followed Clark around. He was so careful to look out for Clark's comfort that, you know, when they were in the Pacific Northwest and there were huge problems with fleas, York would pick the fleas out of Clark's bedding. That's how intimate and oppressive this relationship was. So from one perspective, that sucks. But from another perspective, York made this choice. York could have just been a bad body servant and gotten beaten a couple times and then gotten left in Kentucky, and Clark would have either not taken him or taken a different slave. But York wanted this. And York was able to be an exceptional body servant. He was able to get on this expedition. He was able to see things that most Americans in this time period of any race had never seen. And once he got on the expedition, he was able to do even more. Some of the new documents I found were about York and his ability to handle boats and his ability as a swimmer. And that really matters. On the Columbia River watershed, they were dealing with horrific rapids. You can't see it today because of modern damming, but back then the rapids were harrowing, and Clark's maps really preserved this in detail, where when I was writing the narrative, I would have Clark's map next to me and I'd be like, all right, are they going to hang a left turn or right turn? Like, when are the rocks ahead? And you could do it in that kind of forensic detail. But York was essential to that, because there, most of the people on the expedition were not good swimmers. York was. And so this was one of the ways where York could kind of make more choices and he could stand out in more ways. And eventually they do get to the Pacific Ocean. And there's one of these moments that's so famous in the expedition where they vote on their winter quarters, and Sacagawea and York get to vote too. Now, technically, Sacagawea wasn't included in the vote. She did speak up, but the captains didn't really ask her. You can tell from the way Clark laid out the page that she just kind of blurted it out. I honestly think that's truer to her, because she was an opinionated person. She spoke up all the time, which is remarkable for a young woman in this time period. But York did get a vote. They clearly called on him. And that Lewis and Clark had been taking votes all along. They organized their military structure in a really democratic way. And they let the men have a say, in part, I think, because they knew they needed the men to sort of feel like they were part of this mission and they were relying on each other. But the only time they let York have a say was on the Pacific Ocean. And I think it's honestly more meaningful if we know this is something that they had done throughout the expedition. And then once they make it to the ocean after those rapids, they're like, let's include York's vote too. I'm not saying that York had a vote in any kind of modern sense. I'm not saying York was equal to them, because he wasn't. But I am saying that in some small way, he made choices. He exercised as much power as he could. And the other people recognized that. They appreciated that. I guess it does tell you something about Lewis and Clark, but it really tells you something about York.
That's such a rare thing. I think it's so difficult to come up with intimate portraits of enslaved people's lives at any point in history, even as recently as the 19th century. Like, there are not that many surviving slave narratives. You can be a scholar of slave narratives and read them all. That's how few there are. So to be able to understand the interactions between an enslaved person and his owner and another group of people and the role that person played, it is almost unheard of for this period of time to be able to draw a portrait in that kind of intimate detail. So in addition to all of the other things your book does, like, it is an adventure story. It does tell us a great deal about the United States at the time. It tells us a lot about Jefferson and empire. It is also these other things. And so for that, on top of everything else, I want to thank you.
I appreciate you saying that. But as a writer, I always just kept coming back to the human beings. There was 10 of them who have a point of view. Lewis and Clark are two of those 10. I came to really care about them as I was working on this for the 5 years. They felt like they were alive. And I just really wanted to try to put as much of that on the page. I wanted readers to have a similar reaction, because it is rare to have 10 lives from 10 very different backgrounds all kind of forced together in this crucible of the expedition, including some native people that just sort of, you know, showed up for a little bit and then went on about their lives, but they still had intense interactions. And I just wanted those human beings to feel alive. I wanted you to be in the canoe. I wanted you to feel like you knew York or you knew Sacagawea as best we could.
This book, on that ground, I would say is a complete success. I cannot thank you enough for your time here. The book is This Vast Enterprise. It is one of my favorite things that I have read in the recent past. I urge everybody who's listening to this to go out and buy it, because I guarantee you you're going to enjoy it. Greg Fairman, thank you so much for joining me. I really, really appreciate it. And I wish you all the success in the world with this.
Well, thanks for saying that, man, and keep making these podcasts, because they have been delightful to listen to. And you know, the more we can do to foreground the experience of regular people in the past, the better we all understand the past and the present.
Couldn't possibly agree more. Next time on Past Lives, we'll move a long way to the east, where we'll meet another mummy. She was buried around 1800 BC in the hyper-arid Tarim Basin of Xinjiang. We know her as the Princess of Xiaohe. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe to our Patreon. It's linked in the description here. The Patreon is only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content like Q&As, interviews with scholars, and much more. It's thanks to subscribers like you that we can make this show. If you're already a subscriber, you rule. And thanks so much. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. This has been Past Lives.